Okay, we really don't have any announcements except to say if you have any feedback to give us about the weekend, you can go to the Ex-Mormon Foundation website, and there's information on how to collect, how to write an email to the board. Does anyone have any questions or comments about the weekend that you want to share? I mean,
it's lovely.
Oh, thank you. It was lovely to have you here. Oh, you're welcome.
For a never Mormon visiting for the first time and attending, all you people are just awesome. You really are. You're great people, you know. I've been in lots of groups with lots of different kinds of people, and you're awesome.
If you go to the website, you can get the audio. You go to YouTube for the pictures, but it usually takes. Dan's not in there. Oh, well, it takes at least a week.
Weeks.
Oh, I guess. Okay. At least a month, probably. What they have to do is some of the talks, if there was PowerPoint, they have to get that, you know, and he has to splice that in so that people who see it can see it like we did. So it takes a while, and it's all voluntary, so, you know, that goes.
Sue?
Had a thought through my head. What?
My wife has. Do I need this reading? My voice is so loud.
No, you're fine. You need it. And some of us are getting. So you need.
Okay. Well, we go to the Sunstone Symposium every year, and one of the most popular sessions is Why I Stay. And my wife suggested you ought to have something like that, but Why I Leave.
Well, we do. There's, of course, not enough time for everybody to do it, but we're always stretched for time. But something like that, it would be a good noontime thing, I think, you know, for those who want to participate. And we're always open to anybody who has an idea about a smaller session, like a breakout session. As you've noticed, we don't have any sessions competing with each other, and that's because this is a relatively small conference. And with the work that goes into presentations, we really like to provide the full audience to our speakers. So with there's two roving mics. I'll stand over here, and Tim's over there. And you can ask anybody any question. And we're just going to be kind of open-ended. When people are really done, we'll be done. So that's perfect.
Hello. My name is Judith Homer, and I'm with British Ex-Mormons with Swedish Roots. My question is for Hans and Brigitte, and I don't know if this is too personal or not, but it's one that I've heard a lot of people inquiring about. Did you get your second anointing?
If I did, I couldn't tell you. And if I didn't, I wouldn't know. But I can say like this, that there's a lot of people wondering about the second anointing and what kind of promises. Some people think you can do anything and everything be okay. But I just wanted to tell you that if you read Mr. Phillips' context, there is no wrong in that. Then you can use your own mind and figure out if I have or not.
Thank you.
Did you get that?
Yes, it is an answer. Because I believe you also have a brain.
It's called a squishy answer.
Yes, it is. Because this has been recorded.
My name's Heidi. I'm on the board from Oregon. And my question's for David. When I was a kid, I was taught that the Jews in the Holocaust deserved what they got because they killed Jesus. That was the punishment for, and I was wondering if that is a, and I've mentioned that to lots of people, and they were taught the same thing. Is that a teaching that was, you know, in doctrine, in a manual? Is that something that's just widely believed but was never actually a, you know, a teaching, a doctrine? But that was what I was taught growing up.
Well, I guess the there is there.
If you want to.
Okay. There's a Mormon scholar by the name of Armand Moss. He may not be particularly popular with this group because he tends to be still claim to be a believer. But he is a genuine scholar, and he's done some research on Mormon attitudes toward the Jews. And he found that as he describes it, there are two types of basic anti-Semitism. There's number one, which you mentioned, a Christ-killer anti-Semitism. And you find a lot of that along with a lot of religions that venerate the suffering of Jesus on the cross. The Catholics have a lot of Christ-killer anti-Semitism. And then there is a second type, which is the failure to convert type anti-Semitism. Dr. Moss, in his analysis, rejects the belief that the Mormons. Now, this is his opinion. You know, you may disagree, and it would be fine if you don't. But he rejects the assertion that the Mormons had the Christ-killer anti-Semitism because Mormon theology is such that Christ's sacrifice was necessary. In fact, it was in the Mormon version of it, it was Heavenly Father's plan, okay? But he does say that there is genuine Mormon anti-Semitism along the second line, and that is you failed to convert, so therefore you are evil. Type. And the Mormons did not, they had a few. In my research, I encountered specifically the names of about 10 named people who were Jews who had converted to Mormonism either in their generation or their parents or grandparents had converted, and you know, and so that they had passed it on. The Mormons did not target Jews for conversion, obviously not in Germany, deliberately, because they knew to keep their distance from the Jews. But also, they just didn't do it anyway. So I don't know if I answered your question there, but Fawn Brody talks about, in her notes, author of No Man Knows My History, but also the daughter of Thomas McKay, who was a three-time Mormon missionary to Germany, two times as a mission president. She talks about the country bumpkin latent anti-Semitism that she experienced growing up in Utah. But it was mostly the failure, to put it in Dr. Moss's paradigm, it was the failure to convert type of anti-Semitism.
My name is Herb Berkowitz. I'm a Nevermo. My wife is the Exmo in the family. Heidi has called me Jewish-ish, which I guess is accurate. This question is mostly for Hans and Brigitte, but really for the whole panel. Before the last general conference, there was some expectation or hope that the three vacancies on, and if I'm wrong on the lingo, it's because I'm a Nevermo, the three vacancies among the 12 would be filled with some notion of diversity from overseas or something like that. And as it turns out, of course, it was true blue Utah Mormons. And that kind of confirmed something that I've been thinking, and that is on the subject of, you know, what is the church's hierarchy most worried about? And I think they're most worried about a threat to their legitimacy as the true leaders of the Mormon church because, I mean, I don't think they're that worried about the Book of Abraham or the historicity or the polygamy or any of that. They're worried about some other church, like the Community of Christ, that offers basically the same theological benefits, the same celestial kingdom, but without the anti-gay bias, without the politics that are put in, just in a much more, an obviously more women-friendly, and that it would be a lot easier for people who want to leave and hold on to, you know, that much of their belief system than to leave because they become entirely disenchanted with the church, and that could lead to wholesale desertions. And I just wonder what your reaction is to, you know, that analysis. In other words, the thing that they're most worried about is threats to their legitimacy.
Let's let everybody answer that if you have. Anybody? I think we were all equally disappointed and didn't care.
I'll attempt an answer, or unless you're ready for that.
Go ahead.
So I'm going to speak to this briefly from my own experience, and I would imagine you have probably a very different experience. I spent 2 years in activism for LGBT rights within the LDS Church and watched numerous people go through various kinds of difficult situations with their leaders. And one thing that I think stood out to me is that it's there's a very strong cultural component to becoming a high leader. It's very important that they understand certain kinds of things, because there's a lot of double binds that people are put in. You have to understand the cultural language that's being spoken by leaders. And I watched some bishops who didn't get it bumble certain things, because when instructions come down to bishops about how to discipline, it's rarely couched in very clear terms. So, for instance, Brigham Young probably didn't tell Porter Rockwell, go kill that person. He probably said, take care of that problem. And Porter Rockwell understood how to interpret what he was to do from that. And it also absolves a leader of a certain amount of guilt over how that got carried out. So I think it serves a very important psychological function for people in charge to be able to disown some of the more aggressive aspects that might happen in terms of how their leadership is being carried out. So I think that's one component of why people come from deep inside the culture. And the second piece is it's very important. I'm going to pull back to the control factors. It's really useful to have a person who has extended family in the church, because that adds weight to the different types of control that are based on this threat of social exclusion, and for them to have family that would have risks if they were to speak out against. It's just, I think coming from inside the culture is a tremendous benefit, and I don't think it's thought through that clearly. Those are just some of my thoughts. I could be entirely wrong about any of it. So there's that.
I don't know if anybody knows how they select new 15 people in the top. I guess that's the reason they call it revelation from the Lord. But I do know in the corporation there is statements always talking about we always know who will be the next prophet, because it's always there. Senior apostle, and that is written in the corporation's codes. So don't be worried. It's nothing to do with the church. It's more a corporation how that will be selected. Those two new apostles, three of them, I know two of them, Raspen and Renlund, or in Swedish, Renlund. And they are very good people, very loyal to their leaders. And you can always wonder, why is it that the church, well, if you look at it, the church leadership on those positions always are related to big families, or they are connected through their wife was some of some pioneer leader, or so they're much. Quinn talks about that in his books about extension of power. But for my sake, I would love to see someone else. And I thought they tried and made Dieter Uchtdorf as one of the 12, taking him from Europe. And I don't think he is connected with the famous families of Utah yet. Maybe his children will be, I don't know. But so in one way, there was a very large or big hope that he will be different. But I think it's you know, kind of mold down to a shape, and even if you have your own opinions, so you... You was under the first and the oldest one. And I don't understand the hierarchy that the one who have been the longest shall be more important than the one who comes number 15. Because if you're called by God and you're called to be there, and I guess to be there you should be yourself and tell what you believe in. Maybe it has to do that the first president, the presidency, as I see it now, is kind of very weak. I think the power of the church is more on the legal level, yeah, and public relation, and I don't know if there is any real strong power making the church go the way they like. I don't know if they even know what they're going. But, you know, Brother Packers, he had those three threats, and I think that's the only revelation I think's been true for a long time. So I think he's right there, you know, intellectual and female and homosexual, though. It's a threat, and I think they're working on that. But you know, they comes also very, if I would say, on the right wing of the Mormons, living back where polygamy and revelation was important, and the gift of tongues and things like that. And there are a few around in Utah, I think, that support that. I think they feel threats from all sides, from above, nothing happened, and from the sides where we are and other people. So, but I really like to see it different. It should be good if someone from other countries and backgrounds come into the 12th or 15th. So I don't know if I answer it, but I don't really know. I know there is a lot of computer working with it and a lot of people, because they need a lot of leaders all the time, you know. Every time, every second year, you change mission presidents all over the world and temple presidents, and I guess they select all the time. They find out if they are, because should be 70, and I guess now they have problems that I'm sitting here, and they have to maybe have a new program for the computers to have more stable people. Well,
oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were done.
I'm done.
I'm not sure I have anything. I can't get inside the head, of course, of the 15, so I don't know what their thinking is. They could very well be concerned with their own tenure. But I can guess that they think the church is doing pretty well, and there's no need yet to change. I think the push for representation of other areas or sexes or countries or whatever is probably coming from the more liberal wing of the Mormons, and I think that there are probably a good number who would be upset if a black or something like that would be appointed. And I think they know the people around here better than they know anyone else, and they probably think that they're rightfully due for such an appointment. But I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating.
if that's the name of the game. This isn't a direct answer to the question, but I do think that there's a big disconnect between church leadership and what maybe we would call fringy or liberal Mormons. And fringy and liberal Mormons, in my experience as a former fringy liberal Mormon, is that they think they have more say than they do, and they think they're more powerful than they are. And that sounds really negative. But so they're saying, okay, we want people of different representations, we want more equality for women, for LGBT people, and they create echo chambers where they hear other people saying that too, and so then they think, oh, we're going to get these at this conference. And there's a huge disconnect between that echo chamber that's in a lot of ways online for younger people and then what the church hierarchy actually thinks. And to be even more negative, I don't think the church hierarchy really cares that a bunch of fringy Mormons wanted some people of color. So I don't think they even see those people as a threat. They're not real Mormons anyway, so why would the church change their policies to make people who aren't loyal necessarily and who aren't invested in the church in the same way, why would they do anything that makes them feel particularly happy? And that's sort of been my experience in my own limited way, is that they don't see them as a threat, like your question kind of asked. They see them as a nuisance, and you don't cater to a nuisance. That's the end of my speculation.
Okay, I'm Lyndon Lamborn. I think most everybody here knows me. I excommunicated the church back in 2007. My question is primarily for Peter. I come from a very large Mormon family, and it's been interesting to watch over the years and decades the incidence of mental illness that has occurred in my family and extended family. And I've been curious for years now if there's any information or data that would be statistically significant to compare the incidence of mental illness in highly religious families versus, you know, a secular type of, and I'm open to anybody else wants to comment also. If there's any significant data that you've seen or heard about that would draw a correlation between oppressive religious indoctrination and the incidence of mental illness. Yeah. Any comment would be appreciated.
Well, I'm going to give this a go and evade some of your question and answer some of the other parts. Mostly, I'm not aware of any specific studies currently, but it's a great question. I'll keep an eye out, and obviously if anyone knows of something, please come tell me. To answer it possibly slightly differently, a controlling religion where there's performance-based salvation issues or threats for nonconformance, that tends to have a big impact on certain types of illness that may not be as severe. For instance, if you have anxiety disorder and you grow up in a fairly rigid Mormon family, that actually can make the anxiety much worse. So you have a situation that's creating anxiety and a person who's vulnerable to anxiety. The same thing happens with depression. If you want an interesting read, there's a book called, I think it's called The Narcissistic Family. And there are a number of case studies in the book where a very intensely religious parent is a feature of what's going wrong inside the family. And I think it's a good look into maybe some of the structure of your question. And that seems to be a fairly prominent feature in about a quarter of the cases that I remember from that book. It's not about religion. It's just something that came up a lot as a thing that created this type of dysfunction in a family. Other things that would do that would be a mentally ill parent or a substance abusing parent or a parent with a personality disorder. But religion seemed to play a fairly prominent role in some of those cases.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. First of all, to David, there's been a couple of movies out called Saints and Soldiers here, and very popular in Salt Lake. And they contain stories of where German Mormon militiamen would save the lives somehow of American Mormon servicemen and whatever. I'm curious about, is there any truth to that? And then secondly, there's a story that's going around about Mormon missionaries being able to leave Nazi Germany, and one in particular where they were trying to get him in the railroad station, and one guy that was supposed to find him got up and started singing one of the Mormon hymns to get all that. Is that just fantasy, or is that...
Okay, let me go with the first question. The first instances you talked about were a product of something that occurred down at BYU called the Saints at War Project. And I wish I had it at the top of my head, the two gentlemen that were involved in this. They went around to mostly American Mormon veterans of the war, but also German Mormon veterans who were living in the United States and who had a command of English. And basically, they were fishing for faith-promoting stories. Okay, I don't have a problem with that, except that I know, especially since this study was funded by Brigham Young University and by the Religious Studies Department there, I know that if somebody had said, well, I know my... former missionary companion, he was a soldier over there, and he raped a French female or something like that, you know. That wouldn't have made it into the Saints at War Project. Not to say that that happened, okay? But those type of projects are undertaken with a determined end. In other words, you have your determined end to show how being faithful and being strong in your faith and living a good life and reading the scriptures will protect you in all contingencies, whether that be a skiing accident or ravages of wartime. So I don't doubt the individual stories that come up in these books. There's a book, German Saints at War. There's a book, Saints at War. There's the video you talked about, Saints at War. And I quote some of these things from the German Saints at War. They paint the picture of, for example, for the Wehrmacht veterans who were Mormons. The typical story is, I was out on the front lines and I felt a prompting. And I went over here to this side of the trench. And as soon as I got over there, an artillery round fell on this side of the trench and blew everybody up. So therefore, it was the Lord that prompted me to go over there. Well, to that person, it's true, okay? But I never saw a story saying, well, they decided they were going to have a Sunday morning devotional, and they all gathered in this clearing, and an artillery round fell on them and killed them all. Okay, so that's my answer in that regard. Can you prompt me what the second question is again? What was the second thing?
It's about the end of the war and getting missionaries out of.
The great evacuation, the heroic evacuation of the West German mission. Okay. So here's what happened. First off, during the Czechoslovakian crisis. During what was called the Munich crisis in the fall of 1938, they had what they called the fire drill evacuation. The State Department put out a bulletin when Hitler was meeting with Neville Chamberlain and the French Prime Minister. The Russians wouldn't have anything to do with it because they knew that we were going to appease Hitler, so they wouldn't send anybody. But while this was going on, the State Department put out an all-points bulletin. All Americans should be careful of traveling in Europe. J. Reuben Clark, who had his fingers on the button, with his former State Department colleagues. He was a former Undersecretary of State during the Coolidge administration. He pushed the button, and everybody left, okay? And then when they came back 3 weeks later, the German saints made fun of them because you didn't need to leave. This was a great triumph for Germany. Hitler won these concessions from Chamberlain. Chamberlain went back and said there will be peace in our time and all this kind of stuff. But it was a great victory for patriotic Germans at that time, and they made fun of the American missionaries, said you didn't have to leave. During that time, they found out that in these German branches, some women had prepared and blessed and passed the sacrament, and all kinds of terrible things had gone on, so they had to send the missionaries back, okay, to straighten this stuff out. Well, anyway, so then rolls around the last week of August, 1939. And this shocking event to the left wing of the political left in every Western country comes up, and it's the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And it's the peace treaty between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. Oh, boy, the left didn't like that because their heroes, Stalin, had made an alliance with the devil. But to J. Reuben Clark, and, you know, I don't have a whole lot of regard for this man in certain circumstances, but he knew what was going on. And he said, this can mean only one thing. This means war. This means that exactly what happened, that the Germans were going to invade Poland from the west. 3 weeks later, the Russians were going to invade Poland from the east, and they were going to carve it up. And so he pushed the button again, and, okay, all missionaries scramble and leave. Well, the East German missions, it was now then called the East German Mission, that changed its name in 1938 from the German-Austrian Mission. They all, you know, they were all practiced up. They got on the trains, and they left, and they went up to the Netherlands. They went and, you know, all of this. So, anyway, it went smoothly for them. Wasn't quite so successful in the West because I believe the staging area, and the plan was to go through Denmark. Okay. Problem is that the Danes learned a lesson themselves in World War I when their country was flooded with refugees and they didn't have the ability to care for them. So the Danes closed their border. Unless you had money and unless you had an onward ticket, then you could get through. And later, a week later, the Danes closed the border completely because they didn't want a repeat of what happened in World War I. Well, guess who got whose plans, a monkey wrench was thrown into the plans of the missionaries from the West German mission. All kinds of chaos went on. Now, these missionaries had known that there was a rule in Germany that you could not take any more than 10 marks out of the country, no more than 10 Reichsmarks. Because Germany didn't want its currency, which was backed by a gold standard, in order to leave. So they went in and made last-minute purchases of trinkets. Germans made wonderful cameras. The missionaries were writing home, asking Richard Pohl, who, you know, had a long teaching career afterwards, got all these letters of him writing his parents home, send me money for a German camera. You know, well, anyway, they spent all their spending money. So they had $10 in there, 10 marks in their pocket or less. And they were supposed to get their steamship tickets once they got to their host country, once they got to Denmark. They couldn't show that they had a forwarding ticket. Big chaos. So you had a 3 or 4 day period where the missionaries dripped through, where they sent money. The mission president in Denmark, he sent money to the missionaries. He sent tickets. He knew exactly what was going on. But there's a real penchant for control in Mormonism, and especially in the missions. And if you don't have your fingers on where every missionary is at all times, you feel pretty powerless. So eventually what happened is all these guys got through. They all got through. Everything was fine. The fact is they didn't really need to leave Nazi Germany at the time because the United States didn't come into the war for 2 years and 2 months. And they would not have been in any great danger. They could have gone out orderly. They could have gone back to their post. They could have consolidated at the mission home in Frankfurt in West Germany and gone out orderly there, and made arrangements through the German government to leave. And it would have happened. But instead, what came out of it became another opportunity for faith-promoting scholarship. Okay, David F. Boone at Brigham Young University wrote a master's thesis and 2 published scholarly articles on this great German evacuation. And you will find also your share of faith-promoting books. Mine Angels Roundabout, and I forgot the name of the author off the top of my head. But again, she went ahead. She's a lady in Idaho that in the 80s she went ahead and made it her point to interview as many of these West German missionaries as possible. And to produce a book where the end was predetermined, that it was going to be a faith-promoting book and it was going to tell about all the miracles. So she got hold of local missionaries in Utah, missionaries as far away as Australia and Israel, much older men by this time. And so tell me your faith-promoting experiences with regard to the evacuation of the West German mission. Well, that's what she got. So, yes, there was a situation where one elder was dispatched back into Germany with a wad of cash in his pocket to find these groups of missionaries. And these missionaries were in a train station. The Bahnhofs, the train stations there, were just chaos at the time. And so there's a bunch of group of missionaries that they're singing Come, Come, Ye Saints or some other hymn. And so over the din of the roar, the missionary with the cash hears this and goes and finds them and buys them tickets and they get out of town. So is it total baloney? No. They probably were singing. And they probably, there are no stories in here about angels that came down. Okay? Okay. But they're all faith-promoting, predetermined. It's predetermined scholarship. Okay? Every individual incident stretches every individual incident at the Saints at War. I would not doubt the historical veracity of it. But you know the method that was employed. As I told you guys at this microphone yesterday, I went into researching the Mormons in Nazi Germany with an open mind because I had an LDS child that was looking for stories about persecuted Mormons in a concentration camp. And if I'd have found them, I'd have written them. And if it would have come out and it would have been a book that didn't have a red cover and the Salt Lake Temple and a swastika on a cover, and instead would have been something that would be on sale at Deseret Book and the BYU bookstore, because that's where the chips fell, and you wouldn't be having me here. I'd be at Fair Mormon, okay? But I was going to tell the story that I found. These other authors, I don't believe, went into it with an open agenda. They came in with a predetermined agenda.
Thank you. One last question for Hans. Can you touch on the compensation that's given to 70s and even part of the 15? We've heard rumors that when you're called to be an apostle, you get a big lump sum of money to cover your debts and stuff like that. And would you just touch on that?
Hans, also, if you could also in your answer disclose anything about what you're required to sign in terms of a non-disclosure. We understand that. Well.
That'd be
The only thing I know is that I didn't get any money. They paid for the airplane tickets. Sometime I get some money for, I had some dinners when I was out and traveling. And that's it. I know that the first quorum of the 70 are paid. They don't call it salary. They call it
it's reimbursement.
Oh, wait a minute. My head is just waking up.
Living allowance?
Thank you. Living allowance. And that means you can live quite well. It's not funny. Because they take your tithing money. Well, let's put it this way. This is the way they probably would tell you that if I was not in this calling, I had a much more valuable a job outside the church that will give even more money. So I'm worth more. So this is a sacrifice for me to be here. So now the 12, I don't know. But I don't think they look thin. They eat every day. They have nice cars and, yeah. So I know they have the same thing with allowance. And I don't think they even pay tax for it. So, well, that's all I know. So if you are in the second quorum, third, fourth, and fifth quorum, and so on, you're not being paid, but you will be supported. But that's wait a minute. The second quorum is general authority. They also got the allowance, if I remember right.
I've got a question. So hang on one second.
And of course, they also write books, you know, or sometimes they don't, but someone else do, and they sign them. And they got some royalties from that. Before they were always sitting in the church businesses, companies, but I think that really was not a good idea because there were more doctors than businessmen, some of them, and I think they stopped that. And the next second question you had was if I was what?
I'm just interested to know how widely circulated among the general authorities non-disclosure agreements are, where they require that, you know, if there's a legal penalty if you're disclosing information about finances or operations of the church.
The only thing I can remember now is that it's 15 years ago, you know. So we have to promise in front of the first presidency, everybody who was new on a special meeting with the right hand in the square, and promise that we will not use church materials not be honest with them. And we also promised that we would give everything back because this belongs to the church. And there were some information that we were told not to talk about. But more, I guess, because they don't want the public relation to work too hard. But like, I guess, like, Alapaki talked to us and when we were trained that he said... I have stopped to write my diaries, and I wish everybody didn't write diaries. And he was so upset because so many historians that are looking for history used diaries from members, and probably they wrote down what they thought and not what the church taught. So he was upset. He kind of didn't say we not have to write diaries. But he said, I don't do it. And, well, you follow the leaders, I guess. And one interesting thing, if we talk about money, is I served when Hinckley was the prophet or the president. And they decided the church needed more money, or the corporation needs more money. So they said, we would take missionaries from the poor countries and we'll send them to Canada and U.S. because there are more rich people there, so we get more tithing if we will have missionaries there and more converts. So money talks, it does. And of course, if you look at it, it's not that bad really, because you need a lot of temples and church buildings and missionary offices. I mean, it costs a lot. So, and of course, the poor country don't contribute any money; they just suck the money from the church. So,
I have a question for Earl. Earl, I've been curious about your wife as far as this journey you took towards the culmination of the book took many, many, many years. And has she? Did she stay real active for a long time? Is she still?
She's still active.
Okay, that's what I wanted.
She's still active, and I have two sons. They each have two. They're each married and have two children. They're all active. I'm the only black sheep.
Fun, isn't it?
Sue, behind you, there's a question.
I'm Dr. Craig Wilkinson, an ex-Mormon here in Salt Lake. And being an academician, I always have looked at the history, and we see all these people that are getting excommunicated for talking about true history. And you see the geneticists talking about the Indians and what the true source of the Indians is. And then you watch BYU and the apologies that come up. And my question is, there's no academic freedom at BYU, obviously, because if you do anything against what their idea of what the truth is, you're going to get excommunicated. And my question is, how come they don't lose their accreditation? The BYU doesn't just lose their accreditation from whoever does that accrediting. I'm not sure, but it's obviously a national association that must accreditate colleges. And that's for anybody in the panel.
I know there was a period of time about 10 years ago when they were legal, I mean, technically threatened that they would lose their accreditation, but I don't remember what the issue was. Whatever they were pressured about, they cleaned up, I guess. You know?
I would say that, and I'm no expert on this, I'm just giving you another person's opinion. There's a lot of money and influence. BYU, other than the University of Phoenix, is the largest private school in terms of enrollment in the United States. I hate to say it because it casts some aspersion on the values of and the credibility of the accrediting agencies, but if you're going to threaten Biola College with something because you can't, they don't let their undergraduates practice religious freedom as we see it, there's not going to be as much blowback as not accrediting BYU for the fact that an undergraduate who goes there as a Mormon and has a faith experience and becomes an evangelical Christian gets kicked out. He gets kicked out of his apartment and his many times his transcripts are placed on hold pending church discipline. There's just too much influence that BYU and the LDS Church has, and that's just my venture, and I would love to be wrong about that.
Stephanie, do you have any thoughts about the change with three women being put on some of the priesthood executive councils recently?
I think Mormon people are used to subsisting on breadcrumbs and saying that that's equality. And I think, I mean, sometimes I have to take like my cynical helmet off. I think the purpose of that is the church is moving towards a message regarding gender relations of complementarianism, and it's something they stole from evangelical Christianity, where men and women are, of course, equal, absolutely equal in every way. They just have very different roles. And that's the message that they're pushing now, because the old message, which was much more openly sexist, wasn't working. And I think it wasn't working even for faithful Mormon people. And so I talked about earlier, you don't deal with a nuisance, but like when lots of people start to have a problem with the language about women in the church, you do something. And like the church does with most of its other ideas, they found something that worked in another religion and did Mormon voodoo on it and made it their own. And now that idea is that men and women are equal but have different roles, and then people would answer back and say, well, what are their roles? They don't have anything. And so now they've handed women these positions in leadership opportunities, and now they can say, look, we have given them equal roles, but they're very different, and now we don't have to extend them priesthood. Now we don't have to deal with all of those other issues. And it's their token answer, and it's their breadcrumb. And if you are trying to stay in the church and you are desperate for anything to be sustaining, you might be willing to take that. And from what I've seen, yeah, they're okay with it somehow. But I'm glad that it happened. I mean, I guess any step is good, but it's not true equality. But it's working, I guess. So did that answer
Thank
your
you,
question?
Yes.
Thanks.
I've noticed a lot of laughter and happiness in this group. Now, could any of you compare other groups of Mormons that get together for whatever reason, and what's the general atmosphere?
I'm not sure I fully understand the question. So other groups of Mormons in general, ex-Mormons, post-Mormons, are you asking?
Mormon's happy group.
My family is pretty happy that's Mormon. I think so you're asking about people who are staying in the church, right?
Yeah. And if they have
I think there's happiness. I mean, obviously there's problems. I have problems too. I'm not always happy. But I'd say my family that I know that's LDS, they seem happy.
Yeah, I think as our own experience, when we really had small children, and I was always sitting on the stand, and I think we were very happy when the church ended. And we made it for 3 hours, you know. But of course, then you, as a believer, you're really, really happy when you see your kid will being baptized or he being blessed, and when you follow your son or your daughter to the temple, believing, you're kind of quite happy. And but if you go back and look at the more daily way to look, you can just walk into the high priest group, and if someone had a heart attack, they wouldn't find who it was. They have to try at least 3 times before they find the right one. I mean, that could be so boring sometimes, you know. And even sometime in the Sunday school, I think people just sit there and nod their head and say, yeah, yeah, fine. And I don't really know if there is any questions or not, but they heard that for 16 years in a row, every 4th year. So I think that could be boring, but I think generally, I think Boomer could be happy and are happy, and at least we were. Sometimes we didn't laugh that much, but we cried a lot. So, all right.
I think Mormons are happy a lot of the time, just as much as anybody else is happy, like you said. But something that I've observed, at least in my own personal experience and in my own family, is that it's a very fragile happiness. My parents are very happy people and were very happy when all of their daughters were getting married in the temple and their sons were contemplating missions and everyone was doing as they were supposed to. And even a slight deviation from that plan caused unimaginable grief. And that's not true for all Mormons. There are Mormon people who deal with that better and are still very happy and are more nuanced in their thought. But I think for a lot of Mormon families, the happiness is there and it's real and it's genuine as long as a specified path is being followed. And they've been conditioned that even a small deviation, you know, from I've had relatives who sobbed when their son didn't wear a white church to the sacrament meeting, and that's not strong, resilient happiness. That's very fragile happiness, and you know, so. But again, I mean, I hate making generalizations. If you're a Mormon and you're out there and you're happy, my husband's very happy, like almost irritatingly so, and he's Mormon.
I want to add one thing to that, which is that I think one of the difficulties, and maybe possibly to the point of what you're asking, is that if you're not happy inside a system where you're supposed to be happy, that becomes a very lonely existence. And I think that is a dilemma that happens to everyone. I think a real strength of a community like this is that we're kind of a little more resilient about not being happy, too. That there are reasons you could be happy, and it's okay, and you've got someone you can talk to, and that there won't be a problem. They won't have a problem with you because you're unhappy. And I think that's maybe a fragile thing for certain individuals. So I didn't want to generalize that to a group and say, here's this whole group that's unhappy. But I think it can be a very lonely place to be unhappy.
Okay. I left the church about 20 years ago. Okay. Up before that, I was in for about 30 years. And I was very TBM, you know. I was the last member of my family to leave. Everybody would stay home. I'd go to church, you know, for 3 hours. But once I got out for like 13, 14 years, I didn't do any church or anything, okay? And so I missed a lot of what Stephanie and, you know, the gay community has gone through. And I've been reading some things. And, you know, there are a lot of people with a lot of pain. I would go on the Recovery from Mormonism board a lot, and I would see a lot of people who are grieving and in some very sad situations, and I feel very, very sad for them. And I try to explain some of my travels. Personally, right now, I do go to a church. I go to a Christian church. And it took a long time for me to get back to that point. I have, like, gone full circle. I was a convert, so I had something, a reference, you know, prior to becoming LDS. And eventually, I went back to where I had been prior to becoming LDS, back to something I felt comfortable with as a child. And I feel comfort with that now. And I would try to comfort people, but it's very difficult not knowing where they are. And so I have been reading some comments, and there's a woman in New Zealand that I follow. Her name is Gina Colvin. And I listened to her, and, you know, she's got a lot of pain. But then I'm wondering how long she's going to still be in the church because of, you know, what she talks about. I keep wondering, you know, this woman's going to get excommunicated with her the opinions that she speaks. And for Stephanie primarily, what happens to you when the church comes down on you, you know?
Oh, sorry. I guess I should. Well, shoot. I said it sucks. That's not a very eloquent answer. I think
when it comes down on you, and I mean, I don't know if I'm the necessarily best person to qualify. I read something, I'm stealing this from a book and I can't attribute it correctly, that, you know, you don't leave something that is familiar and important to you until you reach that maximum threshold for pain, when it becomes so unsafe to stay where you are that you're forced to leave. And I think that might explain why that woman you follow is maybe still in the church, that because for right now, where she is painful, but the outside world is still more painful. And eventually you get to that point where being in the church is so painful that the outside world, with all of its leaving, with all of its pain and its agony, becomes the less painful option. I mean, it's just a human survival instinct. Go where you feel the least amount of pain. It took me about 7 years to fully leave. And some people leave so quickly, and it's great for them, but it took me a long time. And so when it comes down, it's actually really relieving in a way. It's painful and it's hard. But I think the feeling I remember feeling the most was just this huge relief that I was done. And in an ironic way, it was a very spiritual experience to really finally be done. And the way I describe it is, all of a sudden, the world was full of color again. It was black and white, and it was horrible, and it was painful, and as crappy and terrible as it was to leave, and painful, and I still feel some pain. I keep seeing the world in color, and so that made it worth it. So that's what happened to me. When I left, the world went back into color, and it was amazing and miraculous in a lot of ways. So it sucked, but then it got better.
Okay, one second. Brigitte, I have a question for you. I have a couple of really close ex-Mormon women friends, and they were converts. One in particular joined when she was 19 and exited when she was about 52, something like that. And her family of origin, of course, were just, they loved it that she was out. And she felt like, you know, quote unquote, coming home, because now she was one with her family again. Did you experience that recently, or how's your family reacted to what's gone on?
That's exactly what I can feel also. We have all been very close to each other, but when we told them where we were experienced, they were so loving and compassionate, and they really wanted to know. So we have really told our story to them, and they are so supportive, and I really, really feel so close to them. So that's so good. So good. Yeah, you know, before that.
I asked if they were nice to her when we were active.
Yeah. They were. But you didn't feel you were really connected, because you have different views on things, and you couldn't really get together and have these conversations that got deep, or because you always respected each other. And I remember when our kids were going to get married, my father, we invited all to the reception, of course, but he gave us a phone call and he said, "You know, I would love to be there. I love my grandkids, but because we are not allowed to go into the temple, we will not come." And he said, "We love you, and we love you, the grandkids, but we feel we are not allowed to be with you at the most happiest moment, so we will stay home," he said. So that's hard, and I really felt sorry for them to not be able to be with us. So anyway, they were able to be with our youngest daughter. She got married in the Lutheran church, and everybody could come, and it was the greatest party we ever had.
Okay, I have a question. Okay, so is it my turn? Okay. Okay, Stephanie, this is for you, dear. Okay, so I tend to be a little bit extreme, a little black and white. When I'm in, I'm in. I'm out, and I'm not a fence sitter. And so a lot of times when I've been, you know, reading all the things about people leaving the church and so forth, and I'm reading about the women who want equality in the church and the LGBT people, and they stay in the church and they say they want to change the church from within, I have to admit I'm always baffled by that, because I'm thinking to myself, well, actually out loud, I think, okay, so the church is extremely authoritarian, and it claims that they're getting constant revelation from God, that the prophet speaks with God on a regular basis. I mean, the prophet speaks with God and gets constant guidance and so forth. And so I'm always thinking, I'm wondering what's going on in the minds of people who feel like members, that they are the ones who can inform the prophet. Like, okay, so are they, you know, so I wonder what you're thinking. You get what I'm, do you get my question? Okay.
Yeah, I understand your question. I have to go back to a mindset where I believed that way. I think people who want to stay and change the church from within are maybe just as driven and passionate about their cause as the people who leave, and then the people who stay and are true believers. It just manifests itself in a different way. And I think the thing about the people like that is they study the history of the church, where individual members did have more power to influence policy and decision. And Mormonism is such a strange religion, because if a 14-year-old boy can talk to God, then why not a member? And I think the authoritarian nature of the church historically is still new. It's a byproduct of correlation from the 80s and 90s, in which we all conform to the exact same thing. But if you talk to other members, older members sometimes, or people who are very familiar with church history, it wasn't always like that. You know, we were an uncorrelated church, and people were coming up with new ideas all the time and enacting them. And if no one stopped them, it was considered good. And I think newer generations of Mormons who study the history, because it's now all readily available, are saying, why did we give that up? Why are we correlating? And so I think they believe they have the power to make that change. And the mindset of younger Mormons is much more about personal revelation rather than that authoritarian mindset of, you know, revelation trickling down to the masses. And I think that's a short answer. I hope that was sufficient. But there's evidence in Mormonism that that's acceptable and appropriate. And then, so then they try, and then they get kicked down, and then they leave.
Yeah. I guess I interpret it always as the church, the you had personal revelation for yourself.
Right.
But the church leaders, they speak for the general population, and when I just say, I'm done with you then, you know. But so I just couldn't figure out how, like, I would think you're losing faith in the leaders, like they don't really speak with God. You know what I'm saying? So, but
that makes sense.
Can I add something? Just not everyone experiences the same church. The church is very different for different individuals, and people have very different reasons. I want to give a different paradigm for looking at that. Some people experience the church as their cultural identity, and the only way to look at that is issues that are similar to becoming an expatriate. Now, I may vehemently disagree with the government of my country, but I don't want to leave my country. I don't want to leave my people. I don't want to leave my homeland. There are a lot of people in that position, and so they are fighting to create a place where they can exist in the place that they were born. Yes. And I think that's a very valid thing, and so I would argue that some of them probably don't see the leaders as inspired, but most of the people I've talked to are Americans, and Americans have very deeply ingrained in them that idea that I can fight for the place that I live to be a place that I can stand to live. Yeah. And I think that's partially what's going on for a lot of individuals.
Sure. Thank you.
I guess you turn it on. Peter, you put up something on the on the board that was so profound, and that was, you don't have to be good. And it was kind of meaningful in the sense that, and it goes with my question, is when we were thinking about things, we just, and started our journey of reading and doing things and participating in that event. I remember our first thing was we would only read source material. We were even going to be good in our you know, activism or our leaving. We were going to be good through the whole process. And my question is, we both consider ourselves smart people, and yet we go 60 years of our life before we notice these things. And how did that happen? How did we? I read section 132 and I cringe. And there's how did that over? Do you know what I'm saying? How did all of that? How did that occur? Were there psychological things at play? All of you can answer because you've all been experienced that or been wounded by that. But anyway, so.
Well, I mean, the short answer is we're humans, and we can be tricked into things. We can miss things. We have loopholes that where we don't notice things that should be obvious. I still discover things. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I never saw that before. I really appreciate you speaking a little eloquently too. I think a lot of people go through this process of, oh, I'm going to exit correctly. I'm going to study correctly. I'm going to speak with my family correctly. I mean, I remember that. I was so poor. My poor wife, who is not quite as uptight and anxious as I am, you know, had to live with me. Like, no, we're not going to use that source. We're going to find this source, and we're not going to talk about that way because that might not. You know, I've had to work really hard to loosen myself up and say, oh, making mistakes is okay, because you're going to make them whether or not you try and be good. So I don't know that I've answered your question about how how could this happen. How come American history isn't taught correctly either, and most of us don't notice that? Well, how it could happen is that the people you trust around you failed to notice and maybe didn't question, and that we as humans have our own innate biases to see our in-group as correct and out-groups as not correct. It's a maybe a mental flaw that our species has, that something could happen better. You might can speak to the history piece of it.
Well, I'm looking at Gene here, and with regard to that, open an American history high school textbook that is used in American schools, and read about the American Revolution. Then go get a Canadian high school history book and see what they write about the American Revolution. Absolutely, you know, we only invaded them three times between the American Revolution and the War of 1812. The same facts are common to both books. The interpretations are different.
All right, is this on? So my question is for you, Peter. Yesterday when you talked about relationships with family, as we leave, a lot of time there's a lot of, I mean, clearly all the steps, but anger is a big one of them. Something I'm facing with my family is the very Mormon no anger. On one side, I'm super grateful that my parents to say, I love you unconditionally, but when Margarita just said that, it made me think, yes, I have no connection. I have these parents who thankfully are trying to be a part of my family and a part of my life. Yet there's this gigantic elephant in the room that needs discussion that is not happening. We've had an initial discussion, but it's almost like, let's just have joy and move on. But I feel very broken not having a relationship any longer. And I just wonder, is the advice from any of you, maybe just you need to start a new relationship, and this is the new relationship? Or do you try to bridge the gap? It's this, the overarching no problems, let's move forward, that is so difficult, because I feel so empty and anxious when I leave them, and just wanting, I guess.
Well, you're not alone. the first thing I would say. And the answer, I think, to your question is both. I think there are some very real boundaries that there's no way around for a lot of families. It's not so, I mean, just a heart-rending question, so thank you for asking it. There are situations where I think people run into a lot. I desperately want the relationship I had or thought I had and probably did have with my family. And all of a sudden there's this spot at which I'm in need and in pain and you can't help me or won't help me. So there's this incredible sense of betrayal because these are your parents. These are the people who you would look to at your worst moment in life to be there for you, to talk you through it, and they're gone. And you can't approach it, and that's very hard. And I would say the answer to that question is that could take a long time, and you probably need someone right now, and you're going to feel very betrayed. And that's normal. The flip side of it is that doesn't have to be the end of the story. They also need time, and they probably also are feeling the same thing you're feeling. In some ways, they might not express it to you because that would be possibly threatening. But most families that I've worked with, the other side of it, they feel almost exactly the same. So the best thing I can say is if there's any way to drop the content, the specific content, and approach it from an emotional basis of, I'm just in terrible pain. I bet you are too. Can we be there for each other? Obviously, if I need to talk through it, detail-wise, content-wise, I need someone else. But perhaps we could both see each other's pain. This is one of the reasons, one of the suggestions was be as vulnerable as possible with your emotions and drop any agenda for I want you to think differently. Try that out and see what can happen, because if you can hold each other in that space, you can at least know both of us hurt, we care deeply about each other, there are ways we can't be there for each other, we acknowledge that, and it's hard. That's as near as I've found to a solution for that, for myself, and as I've watched people go through this for them. But a real emphasis on the shared experience and the shared emotions of the process, and as much as possible, and it requires family who agree to drop their agenda as well. So they need to also be vulnerable enough to enter that. The last piece is a community I would look to see how they've handled it well is the LGBT community. Many of them have, this is so similar to what they go through coming out. And many of them discover, I have to create a new family for myself. And I want to heal my family, but I can't go with no family for 20 years until mom and dad figure it out. Or until my brother or sister figure it out, I have to have a family. And they surround themselves with a new family, and they keep reaching out and working on the family that they grew up with.
Chance to ask a general authorities or former general authorities wife a question before that I always had, so now I have a chance, I'm going to ask it. And this I also is kind of related to something else that's been on some of the critical Mormon websites lately that I caught my attention that I wouldn't even realize myself. The little story about how at General Conference one of the new apostles accepted the calling without even asking his wife, at least that's how the story went, we don't know the details, Elder Stevenson. Well, he told the story in General Conference that when he was called in by President Monson and whoever else was there to be an apostle, he said yes, and then there was criticism from some women that, well, shouldn't he have asked his wife first, or couldn't his wife have been there? So I'm curious, Brigetta, as a general authority's wife, did you ever feel, with your husband having such prominent church positions, honestly, did you ever feel that you weren't as important as him? Or did you justify it like I think many Mormon do, that, well, being a mother is just as important. But did you honestly ever feel that you weren't as important as your husband because he had the big church callings?
First, I want to say that when he got his calling, I was with him. But they really didn't ask me first what my opinion was on that, because, and I think that's so sad, that because as a wife, you know probably more about your husband than anyone do. You live with him 24/7, and could be interesting. I'm in my personality, I'm quite different from Hans. I don't like to be up on the stage so much, and I know he loves that. And so I was quite happy. I didn't feel, but at the same time, I know there is a lot of good women out there who really are talent and outspoken and so nice to hear. So I can only speak for myself. Yeah. I didn't tell you this yesterday, but after a couple of years, I was called as the Relief Society president in the stake, in Stockholm, South Stake.
And I just said, they asked me first.
And you know what? I need to tell you this, because when the secretary to the stake president gave us a phone call, he said, the stake president wants to meet you and your wife, because he wants to speak to your wife. And is that okay? He will come about 1 or 2 hours or something to your home. And I immediately felt what the thing was about. So I start crying. And I said to Hans, I don't want this calling. I know what he's going to ask me. I wanted to be able to go with him. And with his calling, I couldn't. So he came to our home and he asked me. And of course, as a good Mormon member, I never said no to a call. I always said yes. And afterwards, I accepted it. But afterwards, I said to Hans, why didn't you told him? She couldn't. I've been so relieving for me, because this was very hard for me to have this calling, and Stockholm's stake is so large, and I have to make lots of journeys, who took all Sunday, and I wasn't able to go with him, and I was the one who took care of everything in the home and, you know, our life. So, yeah. But I can understand why don't they consider the women's voices more? I think that's so important. Yes.
Want to ask about financial sustainability of the church. I mean, obviously the finances are kind of a bit under lock and key over there, but just wondering if anybody's privy to any information regarding new plans, like direction, maybe another mall or something. And also, I kind of have run wild with ideas as far as long-term where they might head, but again, just kind of where they're heading with as far as sustainability and their investments. Be fun to have some extra light if there is any on that.
Uh,
I don't know if they will build any more malls in Salt Lake City, maybe some other places. But I can say the presiding bishop who took the decision to build this mall, the creek, something I think is called, he said like this, that sometime I wish the Holy Ghost spoke a little bit louder. So I think he had a real turmoil around him when this happened. I have a senior moment right now. I can't remember. Well, thank you. It's always nice to have a wife that is 6 years younger. Come to the moment of seniority and losing some thoughts. One time I asked, I like to talk to the one who is responsible for all the money comes into the church. What do they do with the money? And because they're buying, you know, stocks or bonds or land also. But anyway, after a while, I found this one who is the boss for the investment of church money. I don't know if they were all the money, but it's not the presiding bishop. It's the guy who is not an authority. He's just working man, ordinary. Anyway, so I tried to ask, why is it that, like in Sweden, everybody knows what everybody has in salary, or every company is, you know, you can look on internet and see where, how much money do they have, and where have they placed the money in some bonds or stocks or whatever. Even the churches. But here we don't know anything. And he didn't understand what I was talking. He said, there's so much money, we don't talk about it. Oh, no, I'm not interested how much money it is. I'm interested where do you put it? What do you do with it? I don't know if this is $1 or $3 million a day. I just, what do you do with it? And because some members wonder if or you invest in cigarettes, tobacco industry, or, you know, there are liquor called Absolut from Sweden, if they are owning, having something there or so. But the answer really, I think, is very good. He says, you know, if the church would tell what stocks they own or they put the money in, the members would do the same because they will follow the church, the leaders, because they are inspired. So the church, they know they're not inspired. So they say, because if there's something go wrong, that means the stocks go down and the value will lose a lot of money. And the member also lose a lot of money, and the members will blame the church for not being inspired and helping them to be rich. So somewhere there, the first presidency made a decision that we don't do it. I think it makes sense. But just one or two years ago on a general conference, one of the 12 talked about that I think it was Elder Eyring saying that Elder President Kimball said that, well, I think the value of the stocks will go down, and someone hear that and follow his suggestion, and like faith-promoting stories, for that time he went right, so he was really a real prophet then. So I guess that I'm really sad if they take that as a promoting of a prophet's way to be guided. If it was, why didn't tell everybody so they all can be rich? So okay, that's all I can tell.
So this is a question for the whole panel. The church is well known to kind of be ethnocentric. They're God's chosen, And often the chosen country kind of comes up, that, you know, the U.S. And oftentimes the church leadership is dealing with things that are of political importance in current events in the United States. And I just wonder what that's like. This is probably directed more to Hans and Brigitte, but I'd open this up to anyone on the panel to just talk about how that occurs and how does that make you feel.
Some way we feel jealous that you are a chosen land and a country that everybody lives in, that God himself said this is the right place. You know, but on the opposite side of that, you do not belong there. You're outside. You're not in the chosen country. So it's tough sometimes. It is, because you read in the manuals and the priestly lessons, and sometimes even quote the American president, Washington, someone like that, and there's nothing to do with the church. I did review one year one of the priesthood books, and there were so many quotes from Jefferson, whatever they called your forefathers, grounder, something like that. And I wrote back, take it away. It's better to have church people. I mean, it's enough that we know that you are the chosen country. We don't need to have the leaders of it tell us as well. So, but of course, being a chosen country that you live in, we always follow you, and we feel sorry for you sometimes, because there is a lot of problem here too. You know, there are more shooting in schools than we have in Sweden, and the only one in Norway that killed more than. And you should be interested in, 74 people was killed from a right-wing lunatic. Yeah, it was terrible. So there's just a feeling that you can feel like you are a little brother to a really old brother that tried to tell you what you should do. Follow me, so kind of speak. And many times when I served in Europe, many leaders, they took the manual, you know, and the books that put it on the shelf. That's for America, not for us. And we have to train them that no, it's nothing to do with America. We this is the church, and we are all over the world, and you should not see America. But it is. I mean, if we should have a party in Sweden, celebrate the 150 years of the church, you will have chewing gums, root beer, and, you know, around there. It's nothing to do with the church, but it have to do with American, the American missionaries and so on, you know. So, and pioneers. Why should the Swedish go pioneer? You know, they walk, like, from Jönköping down to Malmö, you know, four days in a hand cart, you know. And I think it's very good, you know, for the Swedish. And the newspaper says, look, Americans are coming over here now and go with handcarts instead of going in Utah. I think it's silly, really. But so, I mean, we have our own pioneers in Sweden. I mean, the first one there, I think they are great and suffer a lot, and maybe didn't walk that long and didn't have oxen, but they have at least horses and trains and so on. You know, my father, he was so into we shall all go to Zion, and of course you know what Zion is. It's not here, no, it's in Missouri. And his prayer was that he should be the last Swedish Mormon leaving Sweden. Say, goodbye, old country, we're going to Zion now. That's his vision. And we don't talk too much about that now, but when I grew up, that was a really big thing.
This is some more anecdotal evidence, but I teach AP American History at a high school that is very, very prominently LDS. We can see four temples from my classroom.
And I think it's been really interesting to teach that subject because so much of my students' testimonies are tied in with their testimony of America. And so their parents get very upset if they perceive their children are being taught something that is anti-American. And for them, it is absolutely synonymous with being anti-Mormon. You talk about something that the country did wrong, you might as well be criticizing President Monson. And so I think, as I've thought about that, as I've been teaching my class, I think Mormonism's connection to America, I mean, I understand the doctrinal roots, but I think in a way it is a form of legitimizing their testimonies because Mormonism is weird. But if they can connect it to something bigger like American history and patriotism and the founding fathers fighting for their freedoms, then it legitimizes what otherwise is a strange and unusual religion. And so I thought that was just an interesting question because as someone who teaches a lot of Mormon kids about U.S. history, they're absolutely connected. And there's the same attitude that just like the church is the only true church, America is the only true country. And fighting against that it's a fun year every time.
So how would these parents feel if you walked into their children's classroom and you were wearing an Obama T-shirt?
They would be furious. We're only allowed to wear T-shirts supporting our mascot, which is a sugar beet. So
that is at school.
Yeah. Anyway. No, I do my very best, and I'm sure I fail in dozens of ways, but I do my very best to teach what really happened, to look at different sources, to not just rely on the textbook, which is heavily American exceptionalist. There is a lot of pushback. It's hard. It is not easily accepted, and there's pushback from parents. There's pushback from the community. There's pushback from the kids themselves, where when a math teacher teaches, like, this is this, no kid raises their hand as like, well, 2 + 2 doesn't actually equal 4 because my testimony says so. But in American history, when you say Americans did this thing, you get like 5 hands being like, well, the Indians, they didn't really want the land. Like, or, you know, like, but we had to bomb Pearl Harbor, or we had, you know, like, or no, we had to bomb Hiroshima. Like, and there's this deep connection rooted in Mormonism to patriotism with America, and it makes it challenging, I guess is the best word to say. Oh, sure.
What grade do you teach?
11th grade.
So how about the idea that Brigham Young and the prophets thereafter for many, many decades did everything they could to withdraw from America and to countermand all of the laws and everything that, you know, to be anti-American, actually.
That's tied into that's the American revolutionary spirit. Brigham Young was just like Thomas Jefferson going against a tyrant, but it worked out okay because God. That's the
shame. You probably couldn't get along with telling him that Brigham Young had all the liquor distribution permits during in Utah at his time.
Yeah. This is just kind of a follow-up question to current events. In your guys' experience in Europe, like obviously, you know, marriage equality and LGBT rights is the hot topic here in Utah especially. Like has gay marriage, like has marriage equality, is that like a current event as far as, you know, church members over in Europe and what your experience is? Or is it kind of like, wow, why are the American Mormons freaking out, you know?
I think especially in Sweden, we have progressed these questions a long time, and they have come a long, long way, I think. So,
come in. Hello.
But I'm not sure for the rest of Europe. I'm not really so educated about that. But I think in Sweden they are really being accepted. you know, these pride parades. Even the crown princess, Victoria of Sweden, she was the head speaker of a pride something on their banquet or something. And she really made it such a great talk, and she, people standing up and give her this really thanks for their, from their heart, and she was extraordinary. So I really think they are treated well. But still, of course, well, there are opinions. Yeah,
I think that it's not easy, really. So it's, sometimes it's hard to understand when the church talk about not the LGBT should be married or not, because that's what they do anyway in Europe, most of the countries. So that people don't discuss it too much, you know, and they don't understand the question. Why should that not be legal? I mean, people love each other, fine. I mean, if someone loves someone else, then it doesn't affect me or my children. I mean, I don't need to love someone else. I mean, I'm still with Birgitta. And, I mean, so it's kind of a non-question. And
but like, how does that affect the Mormon members in Europe? Do you think that would be like a red flag topic for
them? Well, in that way you put it, question, it affects a lot of the Mormons that are PR people. Most of the Mormons don't understand why the church are acting as they do. But there are, of course, some core members that try to understand why the church doing as they do. But it's not a big issue. There isn't, as I see it.
My name's Ethan Croc. I talk weird as well. I'm from Australia. And when I grew up in the church in Australia, we were constantly encouraged by our church leaders to learn and study and go on to tertiary education. And it's just so funny that me and my wife, when we started to, when we went to university, and we started to get be able to research better and study better, is when we started finding a lot of the inconsistencies with church history and the truth claims. And so I guess I haven't been going to church for a couple of years now. I haven't really been listening to my leaders. Are they still encouraging education? Because it seems like a lot of intellectuals now are leaving the church. Are they concerned about in people becoming too smart to stay members of the church? I don't know. It's to anyone. Because the question is for any of you on the panel who's thought about it. I mean, like, to me, I've discovered that Mormonism is a psychosis where you have to reject fact. You have to reject information that is measurable, that is logical, that is recordable. And, you know, like the young lady was saying about the LGBT, I know in Australia we're very, very liberal down there, and, you know, every Mormon down there is just, it's polarizing to them because they're double downing on crazy and becoming even more angry against LGBTs because they see it as pressure against their precious church, which in their psychosis is God is the whole truth, and, you know, the world is just all wrong, and all the information is just all Satan's plan to deceive everyone. So I don't understand. I mean, at some point, is the church going to say it's okay to study, but don't study certain, subjects? I mean,
well, so I don't know that I have any information, but I can speak from my own personal experience that it's okay to study, but don't study certain things, as was certainly preached to me. I was told at firesides not to become a musician or a dancer or an artist. but that all falls within, I want to give you my perspective on, I think that the education is very much tied up in the self-sufficiency teachings that you really can't, I think there's a very real recognition that you really can't earn the kind of living that you might like without an education, and I would suggest that they really would like you to earn a good living, because they will benefit from that. Everyone will benefit. The worldwide church will benefit from members earning a good living, and I think they're still very interested in that. I have noticed there's some efforts to enhance the church's own educational infrastructure, but I haven't watched it very closely. So that's all I know.
I have a comment on that. If you read recently when Boyd KKK Packer, as I'd like to call him, he made reference to the fact and that he kind of certain. There was a certain time in the history of the church, about in the 70s, when actually my grandfather was commissioner of education for the church. He was pro-birth control, for one thing, my grandfather. And, of course, they were very much against it. And if you get that article, and it was just a few months ago, he said Boyd K. Packer came upon some people from the University of Chicago that wanted to do the church education system much like they were doing back then, and he was totally against that, that faith has to trump intellectualism. I mean, he just comes right out and says it. You don't have to look for it. He just says it. He just says faith is what has to trump here. We cannot have this church education system go towards a university-type situation where we study things. We understand things. We try to find facts about things. And you just read that article and you'll see it. They just might as well mentioned, put my grandfather's name in there. My aunt actually called me and said, have you read that? I said, what? And I looked at it and said, yeah, they might as well just said Franklin L. West. They might as well said that because that's who it was. He had a PhD in physical chemistry from the University of Chicago and was church education commissioner until they fired him. Fired him over birth control. He said, every one of you general authorities know that these people can't have 8 kids. They're poor. And you better let them have the number of kids they can afford. And he was fired.
Greg, what article was that?
That was, when Boyd K. Packer died, all those tributes they have in the paper. Yeah. Just go back and find Deseret News about, when did he die? 6 weeks ago or... So a couple of months ago, yeah.
Question here. We're gonna take two more questions. She's next, and then you, and we'll do one more.
I wasn't here yesterday, so I missed out, and I'm very impressed with all of you. This is going to be kind of a reverse question. I need everybody. Excuse me. Can you hear me? I need everybody's help because I'm leaving the church and I'm an extremely prominent family. I don't really want this taped and I'm nervous. I spoke out at Sunstone once and I got in trouble and I was terrified that the strengthening of the church committee would find me and excommunicate me. And I know too much. It's my problem. I grew up with all these people. I grew up with Tom Monson. One of the other prophets is my uncle. They were in my home growing up. My father was a manager of the Deseret News, and he would come home and say, there are so many things I'm not allowed to print because I have to meet every week with the general authorities, and they tell me what I print and what I can't print. I remember as a little child thinking, that is really scary. He's a journalist, and he can't print certain things because they go against the church. And I started questioning things then, but I was so uncertain because these people were surrounding me, and I was related to them. And I live in terror, and I live in fear, and I desperately need a home where I feel safe. My husband is extremely active. He's been a bishop and high counselor. I guess he brought me down today, but I'm terrified. I really know this is not the truth. I've lived it. I actually had to go to Tom Monson once, and I had to say, please do not use my parents as an example. He was using my parents as an example almost at every conference address as the most outstanding family in the church. And our family was crumbling. I had to go and beg him and say, do not use our family, please. And I ended up telling him some things about my family. All these are very crazy stories, but I know these people too well. And I know too much, and I read too much. But I actually live in terror and fear. I'm actually terrified right now. And I need a home.
Your home.
And I'm older, and my grandchildren are growing up in the church, and I can't go to any weddings and all of that because I don't have a temple recommend, and people are always saying, I can't believe you're this way. Look at who you are and related to. And I'm always judged, and I can really tell you how judgment feels when you're on this side. And I'm always told that I'm making the wrong decision. And I've had so many miracles in my life, and why aren't you believing them? And what's wrong with you? I can't tell you how many times I've been asked, what's wrong with you? And I just have a question. I need help because I don't know what to ask. I just, that's just where I am.
I think you're in the right place, and let's make sure we connect you with some communities of
that
people who
great.
Can provide you support and friendship.
I would love a support group or something like that.
I think we've got several people, and I'm going to suggest that the people who I'm looking at one, who should go find you, take a good look at her and go find her after we're done here.
Thank
or
you.
Right now you can sneak over.
It's probably not appropriate to say what I'm saying, but I have to say it.
It is appropriate.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You're in the right place.
Oh, no. The last presidential election, somebody very prominent in the church, I think his name was Mitt. I think he was supposed to save the Constitution. I'm kind of curious, where does the church go now with politics? It feels like it's kind of lost. I have a lot of family members that are just totally disillusioned, and it feels like wherever the church goes, all the members go in terms of a voting block. So it's really unclear if there's someone that's going to emerge to kind of save the church, especially since, you know, the Mormons and the Constitution, the U.S. are so wrapped up together. I'm just curious. I don't know if anyone wants to take a crack at that.
Well, I can start just a quick. When I talk to general authorities about this, many of them really, I don't know all of them, but the one I talk to are more afraid for Mitt because he could probably change the church more than what we do because they can feel like he can put pressure on the church so he can be a good president, you know. Like the some of the questions like LGBT and the women and things that he probably would have a lot more influences than those who are ex. That's what I said, yeah.
Sue, I don't know why you continue to involve me in this.
Continue.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm probably as discouraged with politics in Utah as anyone in the room. Very right-wing, and I'm liberal, so it's difficult. Where's the church going? I don't know. I just don't know. I can't see it getting any more liberal, but I don't know how it cannot get more liberal. And I guess that's about all I have to say.
As a newbie to this conference, and maybe it's appropriate for a final comment, I just want to thank you all for the what you've made a difference in our lives, but especially for Hans and Birgitte. It was your interview on the New York Times that made a difference in our family's life and brought us to where we are. We so appreciate you, and even though it's been a very painful trip for us and our families don't understand us, we would rather stay on the side of truth, and it means a world to us. So thank you for your courage in what it's done for us. In relation to that, it just really seems the avalanche of information is just coming so strong now. And in the past, you could always say, well, all this stuff is anti-Mormon lies, until the church came out with the essays saying, no, all those things are actually true, and here's the spin. And now with October, with the Searstone article, it just is so blatant of how this stuff is not what we've been taught. And being raised in a black and white culture, I would like to ask the panel to pull out your Searstones and give us your thoughts on how long will it take my family to understand we're not crazy.
Last night. Sue gave away my Searstone.
I'm going to have to ask Google. I'll be back in a minute.
I think seriously, I think the church has given up on this generation, and they really, really like to save the next generation. That's what I think will happen with the church. And that's the reason why they now teach the real history. But they, of course, they are biased in the way they present it, but at least that's what I do.
I just say keep an eye on Mormonism internationally, especially in the developing world, where they may not everybody in every country that may become a Mormon may have the access to the internet or may not have the linguistic skills necessary to learn what our generation and our children are learning with the click of a mouse button. Keep an eye on that, and I would speculate that there is a lot of speculation going on in church headquarters about how they're going to fight that battle once the international church, which now is just as big or bigger than the domestic church, gets some communication ability and starts learning what we have learned.
This has been really great this morning, and I think we could go on for another 2 hours, but people are tired. People have planes to catch. I want to thank you for coming. I want you back there who said you needed a community and a friendship. There are plenty of people who will be contacting you if you'll give them some safe contact information. Because there's a lot of groups, and being this, I keep thinking all weekend. I think it was you, Brigitta, when we was online, and you said something about when I was going back and forth with them discussing their coming, about coming here and being with their tribe, and that word just encompasses it to me. And I kept thinking that all weekend. This is the tribe. This is our tribe. And I'm actually reading a very interesting book right now. It's mostly just a historical telling of what led up to the settlements in the West and the Indian Wars and the Revolution. And this whole discussion about how closely tied the church has been to the whole story of the birth of America. I mean, I remember I grew up in the 50s, and it was just so, I mean, that was the Bircher Benson era. And I just thought it was all one and the same. You know, I didn't divide it in my mind at that time. Anyway, thank you for coming. Thanks for your support. And did you have something? Oh, great. Thank you. Cliff has been willing to set some time aside here. He's going to have a meetup, post-conference discussion and social time at 2 p.m. at the Red Rock Brew Pub. And I think most of you local people know where that is. In fact, that was the first brew pub I was ever in where I met a group of ex-Mormons who were meeting there. That was the place in Salt Lake that they first started, you know, being so wicked. So it has a lot of history. All right, we'll disband now, and be sure you pick up your things, double-check your rooms, and thank you again for coming.